Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
He corresponds with high profile and some he with convicts, serial killers and stuff, and he. He's got quite an interesting history, so we thought we'd bring him on. Cody Lockie, how are you doing, Cody?
I'm good, Alan. How are you doing? You okay?
Yeah, well, you know. So this is you've got quite a history. How did you get started in how your life turned out? Like, where? So for people that don't know, he's been to prison a few times, and he's had a rougher start than let's say me or Julie, but let's talk about your history a little bit to catch people up on you.
Yeah, so I was born in a place called Huddersfield, which is in, obviously, in the UK. It's in West Yorkshire. I was my mother's firstborn. The relationship broke down. She got with another guy. That was his first daughter, so I slipped to the bottom of the pecking order. Their relationship broke down, and then she met another guy, and they had a daughter, so that was his first child. So again, I think I came somewhere behind the cat in the pecking order again. And like I say, I used to play up for attention. I was getting battered at home, locked in a room, had to urinate and defecate in a bucket, curtains nailed to the wall, locked in a room against my will. Going to schools, getting bullied, absolutely battered. I had big ears. I was just bullied, called taxi doors, dumbball, all the usual stuff. And what it was doing every time there was an incident, it was like throwing a bottle of, I guess you guys call it soda in the States, throwing like a bottle of Coke against the wall. And it was just bubbling and bubbling and bubbling and bubbling. And then it eventually exploded and stuff. And I just tried to take my own life when I was like, I tried to hang myself in the bathroom when I was about 12, ran away from home, was sexually abused. Just all sorts of stuff that's go on. And like I say, I can speak about it openly now simply because it's like it used to own me and it ruled me for a long time. But then when I came to terms with it and I accepted it was part of my life, it's part of me now and I accept it and I can talk about it because I've come to terms with it in many regards.
Cody, the experiences you have, we know that young people and children who go through those, you know, what you've described as horrific life experiences, will, if they don't receive the appropriate support to not just come to terms with everything, because there's one thing about coming to terms and understanding, and there's another part that's understanding the impact that has on us. That they need some support when they're growing up and need that help. Did you ever receive anything like that?
No, I didn't know. I was definitely the black sheep of my family, you see. And like I say, the fact is, because I started to rebel and started to play up and stuff to get attention, my opinion was, well, I'm the black sheep, I'm out of the loop. So if I play up to get attention, albeit negatively, attention's attention in some which way. And like I say, it didn't get me attention. All it did was get me the very heavy end of a belt buckle. Or like the first time my nose was broke, it was actually my mother that broke my nose. It was just, violence was part of me. I mean, if you raise somebody with love and affection, chances are they stand a high probability they're going to turn out to be loving, like, kind-hearted people. If you raise people with hate and violence and stuff, you very easily to become a product of your environment. And I very, very much so was a product of my environment. I mean, I used to sit at home, like, when I was locked in my room and stuff, and I was actually having, like, dreams and stuff and, like, fantasizing about murdering my mum and my stepdad. And I say that to my shame now and stuff, because I've actually got a really good relationship with my mum now. But then the pain and the suffering and the bullying at school and being levered at home and stuff, I was just, it was the aggression that was inside me was just boiling and boiling and boiling, and it was going to explode, and it did explode. But like I say, I got kicked out of school. I was disruptive in class, both in primary school and in secondary school. And like I say, it was just part of me and stuff. And I'm not proud of any of these things and stuff, because like I say, I went on to, from being a victim of violence, I went on to obviously perpetuate violence on other people, to a very, very, extraordinary, put it like this, I've been arrested by armed police and stuff like that. I was known for carrying weapons and stuff, because I wanted to hurt people as much as the anger I'd had in me for all my life. When I kicked off, I mean, I was bullied up to a point where I was in year seven, which is in secondary school, which is like the first year of secondary school. And this person that kept like non-stop bullying me, and we was on the yard one day, and he was supposed to be one of, they call it in the UK, like the so-called cock of the year. It's like the hard man of that year in school. Now, we ended up coming to, like, he knocked into me, and it became a fight situation, because that's what he was trying to get out of me. People started to gather around. All this violence and stuff I'd suffered, and all this, like I say, throwing the, like a bottle of soda against the wall, it exploded there and then. And I really, really did this guy some damage. I battered him, and I battered him bad. And it led to me, like, getting in trouble with the teachers and the head of the year, and then I ended up being excluded. And from that moment where I kicked off and I actually lost the plot, literally, I realized from that moment that don't ask questions, just fight back every single time. And violence is actually a very good tool to control people and stuff. And if people feared me, then they would leave me alone. And I've, to my shame and to my detriment, I carried that mentality for 30 years plus.
And you've developed over that time, you know, a huge insight, and described being the victim to being, as a young person, that would be a natural position no matter what was happening. You are a victim, you're vulnerable, you're exploitative. And then you go through this phase where you regain that control and that power, and you exert that over others in the same way that you have found through being a young person that that's what you needed to do to get to where you need to be in life. And then you get to this next point in life where you've reflected on all of that and suddenly thinking, well, I've made sense of it and I understand it, and I almost forgive for that. So that's a huge journey to go through, Cody.
That was only my young years, though. That was like pre-teens and stuff. That was, and then, like I say, it sort of, what, once I set that, this monster that was inside me that was bubbling away, was just when I unleashed it in that year seven fight on the top yard at the school that I went to in Greater Manchester. I never looked back. And from being the victim, I said to myself, I ain't going to be the victim no more. Now, there's a fine line, though. I despise bullies to this day, and even when I was incarcerated and stuff in prison, I actually would defuse situations, or I would get involved in situations that didn't involve me, because my conscience and my mind was telling me, what you're seeing isn't right. That guy's bigger than him. He's bullying him. Interact. And I think that stems from my childhood and stuff. And like I say, it ventured into criminality. It started off small. I was first arrested when I was like 12 years old, and it was over a bloody Kinder Egg. I gave my mate a pound. He went into the shop. He came out. He'd stole it. I was waiting outside. He handed it me. By handing it me, it had been stolen. It was stolen goods. The manager grabbed us both by the collar, brought us in the shop. We wasn't arrested per se. We were taken back to, I was taken to my mum's address. I could see her face on the front doorstep. I knew I was going to get battered. And I was more bothered about that. Then I started attacking my mate in the back of the police car because I knew what was becoming when I got through that door. I knew I was going to get battered. Like I say, just those swings and roundabouts, but again, wasn't academic in school, was kicked out of secondary school, went to another school, disruptive, non-academic. Saw the fact that my mother wasn't academic, and as such, she struggled to put food on the table working like minimum wage jobs and stuff. And I wanted better for myself. So what I did is I saw the criminal route as a fast route. But then my nana died as well. My nana was like my role model. Like my nana was the one person that I trusted. She was my idol, and I idolized her. And like what, 6 weeks before my 17th birthday, she tragically passed away from a massive heart attack. And that was it. I was drinking. I was trying to cause fights. I wanted to hurt people. I wanted people to feel the aggression and the violence that I had inside me. I wanted to unleash it on the world because my nana had been taken and stuff. But the thing is, as I sort of calmed down, I remember that I made my nana a promise when I was about 8 or 9 years old. My nana said, what do you want to be when you're older? And I said, well, I want to be an army man, like action man, like soldier. So we made like a little pact. Many like years later, I actually, like after she died and stuff, very shortly after she died, I applied to join the British Army, which I did in her memory. My family were telling me I couldn't do it, putting me down. I did it. I passed all the tests and stuff, went and done my beat up in Scotland, in Edinburgh. And just sort of that unleashed a new monster, though, because it's very cliche saying you train to kill, but that is, as a soldier, I was already desensitized. I was all on the brink of being dehumanized. And then you're giving me weapons and you're teaching me, like I say, we did like things from unarmed combat to small arms to firearms and stuff. And it took a new angle to my aggression and to my violence that I was perpetuating on people. And I was drinking a lot and I was based in Germany. I'd get into fights. And I'd attack people, and like rather than walking away when I've knocked them out or whatever, I'm trying to put bottles in the throat. I'm trying to kill them. I was trying to kill people. It's as simple as that. And I say that to my shame and to my detriment, but it is what it is.
And that's why you were serving.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think two reasons, right? I wanted to hurt people, but on the opposite side of that, what I wanted to do was it was for my nana's memory in one way. I wanted to hurt people, and you can do it legally in the army. That's another reason. The other reason was because if I didn't go to join the army, I saw the army as like a way that, oh, well, because the way I'm going, I'm going to end up killing someone. I'm going to end up in prison. So that was also a reason. I was living at home. I was just turned 17 in the December, and I was like, you know what? I don't want to do this no more. And then I joined the army, and to be honest, the army probably made me worse because, like I say, I started to get into boxing and stuff like that, which, again, you're being taught how to hit harder, how to hit faster, how to transfer your weight to get the most out of a punch by, like I say, swinging your legs, like swinging your hips and stuff, and the momentum travels through your gluteus and cross, and then when you hit someone, you get the most impact out of your punch. I was also, away from that, I was studying, like, pressure points, jugulars, veins and stuff like that, places where like arteries and stuff. So if you get into trouble, like go for the arteries and switch off points and power points and pressure points, so you could get the most impact if you come into a violent confrontation. Again, it made me worse. Again, brought me to trouble of the army. I ended up being I ended up being put in a psychiatric unit near the up near the border called Vegberg, which was a British and American base. Was in a psychiatric unit there. They applied for my discharge on the fact that they said you've got psychopathic tendencies. You should never hold a rifle again. And being a soldier without a rifle is just no fun at all. And as a result, I was discharged from the military, came back to the UK. I was then homeless because I'd had a breakdown with my family communications. I was living in a park thing up in Haywood in Greater Manchester. Some people that were drunk came through, and I was asleep, and they started on me, and I knocked one of them spark out. The other one didn't want to know. And then I ended up sleeping in an outside power station for a few months, eventually got into a homeless hostel, eventually got a council flat, got security qualifications off my own back, started to work the doors, got involved with the local drug gang that was moving on a massive, massive national scale, moving kilos and kilos of heroin. I got into the gym. I was taking steroids. I had this hair trigger temper, which meant that I could earn money from my remorseless aggression. And that's exactly what I did. And then it transpired from that I became involved with a notorious gang from Manchester. I was working on the doors. So by night, I was protecting people, as in I was working as a nightclub bouncer, doorman, protecting people. And I took a great pleasure in that. I enjoyed looking after people and protecting people. By day, or when I wasn't working on like nights in the week, I was going through people's doors, balaclavas, weapons involved with firearms, and just went from there. Do you know what I mean? It was, and then I became involved with a notorious Manchester gangster by the name of Dominic Noonan, and again was in the eyes of the police. I was like his loyal right hand man. I don't say that. That's just the way that it was perceived to the police and stuff. And I don't know. It's part and parcel of life. And like I say, I'm not proud of a lot of things I've done, but I was definitely a product of my environment. Now, I know right from wrong, but the fact is this aggressive natured side of me was made, in my opinion. And like I say, I don't know if it was like a generic or I inherited it from, because my mum was a very feisty, fiery woman. I don't know if that was what it was, but like I say, it is what it is. Simple as that.
And so, you describe being first imprisoned at the age of 30.
Yeah.
And some might say absolutely, you know, I mean, you're in that area, so Strangeways might not have been the most unusual place. But actually, Strangeways is a Cat A prison, HMP Manchester, as it is now called, and notorious for high-risk prisoners. I was reading an article earlier that you'd written about your first 24 hours in prison. And
yep.
Even though you are quite worldly wise, you've had to look after yourself from a very young age, right through your criminal life and your army life, and then latterly when you were homeless, etc.
Yeah.
And probably just for clarity, Cody, what people who are listening in America may not understand is that here, there is, it's very difficult for somebody, a single male who is deemed to be okay, to get housing when they're homeless. It's really difficult. And it takes a long time for certain age groups of people who are not deemed high priority to be supported with those services. And a lot of people find that a real pressure point, especially when they're coming out of prison. So for you to be, people might say, well, actually, you're a member of the armed forces and you've come out. And then you were homeless is unusual, but the fact that you were medically discharged and you were in an age bracket where you would have been deemed an independent young adult, you wouldn't have necessarily been a high priority. So just thinking about that point when you, so you're in court for sentencing, and I'm not asking you to give the crime that you were sentenced for, but then you were told that you're going to serve a sentence at Strangeways. How did that feel?
Well, what it was, I was actually arrested because, like I said, I was involved with this notorious gangster, Dominic Noonan, who, like I say, Documentaries have been made about him. He's part of the notorious crime family, the Noonans. And what it was is I was actually arrested on a witness intimidation charge stemming from four alleged phone calls, one which was attributed to being made by me. Now, these people, former friends of ours, were under police protection because they saw the threat as quite credible. They had CCTV placed outside the house, dictaphones, call recording apps on the mobile phones, things like that. And four calls were alleged to have been made, one by me, three by other people. Now, the three by other people were recorded. The one that was attributed to be made by me miraculously wasn't recorded simply because it didn't take place. Now, I was arrested, questioned and charged within the space of 12 hours. Because it was the weekend, I was arrested at 3 o'clock on a Saturday. They kept me in till Monday morning because there's no court on a Sunday. So they put you before a magistrate's court on the Monday. And before I'd even gone up into the court, I had a meeting with my brief, with my solicitor. And he said to me, even if you get bail, which means obviously I'd be going home, he said, you're not going to get bail. He said, I've spoken to the Crown Prosecution Service, who, like I say, they bring the charges. The police gather the evidence, the CPS is down for them to charge you. And he said, even if you get bail today, the CPS are going to appeal, the Crown Prosecution Service. So I knew, he said, tonight you are going to Strange Ways. And I'll be honest with you, I knew that it was always going to come. It had taken the police a long time to get to this situation where I'd actually, like, for all the things I'd ever been arrested for, some very serious offences. And they end up remanding me on a witness intimidation with no evidence, no call recordings, no forensics, no DNA, no nothing. But when he told me I'm going to Strange Ways, I'll be straight with you. As guys, we do this whole macho thing, and it's a masculine thing because, well, we're men and it's prison and we're not bothered. The reality was I'd hurt a hell of a lot of people, and I was very mindful of the fact that this notorious prison that, even though I was a hardened criminal, I had never been a jailbird, so I'd never spent time at Her Majesty's pleasure. So it was really, really a shock to the system, and they placed me in I went up into the court, I got bail, the CPS appealed, they waived this piece of paper, and then the judge obviously remanded me into custody, and I'll be honest with you, when I stood up in the dark, my legs were like jelly, I'm not going to lie to you, they really was. And like I say, it was the fear of the unknown, because I've mastered a lot of things in my life, I'm very streetwise, but this was a world that I'd ran parallel to by being a criminal and being involved in serious organized crime, but I'd never been to prison, and there's prison rules, and then there's prisoners' rules, and I was put in this prison van, we call it a sweatbox, but it's a prison van, with a couple of other prisoners. They popped the door, and then they just said, right. And then we pulled up at this gate that I've been on visits to this prison, this notorious prison, the scene of the Strange Ways prison riot back in 1990, the longest in the criminal justice system here in the UK. And I'm going through this gate, and I'm like, oh, my God. So then they pulled the other lads off. Then I was the last one off the van, getting strip searched and stuff like that. And because I'd been on documentaries, the prison officers knew who I was, which wasn't a good thing because they spoke to me like rubbish, and they're like, right, get in there, get naked, and you're getting strip searched, and then you have to sit on this like chair, which is to detect metal within your body for mobile phones and things like that. I was very nervous, I was very anxious. And like I say, I could have done the whole macho thing and say, oh, it's easy, blah, blah, blah. The reality is I'm not going to glamorize it. And even though I'm quite a hard person physically and emotionally through my life experiences, I was very, very scared, very anxious, and like worried about what was going to come. And then, like I say, you go through the process of stuff of being processed, taking your picture, getting strip searched, sitting on a chair, handing your prison issue clothes, putting me into a holding cell. They give me food in a polystyrene tray, which you wouldn't give to your dog. Saw the nurse, made a 2-minute phone call, and was in this room for several hours until they ended up eventually taking us to this wing and stuff. And everything that I thought prison was, when they opened this door and said, right, here's the wing, and you walked onto this wing at this notorious prison, high security prison. For those that don't know, in the States, prisons here in the UK are categorized. Category A, which is your high security facilities. Category B, which is like a medium. A Cat C, which is a lower. And then you've got a Category D, which is an open prison. Obviously, in between that, you've got STCs, which are secure training centers, which house children, and then obviously you got female prisons as well. But I walked onto this wing, and I could see from the ground floor up to the top floor, which is called the fours, and everything that I'd ever seen of prison documentaries and stuff down to, even though obviously Shawshank Redemption, even though that was filmed in the States, it was the same sort of makeup as in, you can see from the ground floor to the top floor. And I was now in this notorious prison as an inmate. And like I say, you've got to learn quick. And because I was a big guy, that doesn't mean that you're higher than anybody. It actually can mean that you can be a victim, because people can see you, the size of you, and see that as a challenge to try and assert some sort of dominance over you. That never happened, luckily for me, but you've got prison rules, you've got the prisoners' rules. The officers, for the most part, for the prisoners in the UK, you've got private prisons, which are, like I say, run by Sodexo, G4S, things like that. And then you've got the public sector, which is run by Her Majesty's Prison Service. Now, HMP officers are a lot more by the book and a lot more unapproachable, for the most part, than private prison officers. But I spent 22, 23 hours a day locked up in this notorious prison. I saw suicide attempts, I saw self-harm, a prisoner set himself on fire, cell fires, people covered in their own excrement, fights, violence, just death, misery and despair of the highest order. And it stayed with me, but it didn't deter me, because I'd went to prison two further times on two other stretches and stuff. And I don't know, it's just prison, isn't it?
And I think that one of the things that is really difficult about going into prison in the UK is depending on the support you can get, and training and that rehabilitation stuff. So the shorter your sentence, the more likely you are to go and to reoffend when you come back out as a survival, because it's what you know. So moving on slightly from that, so you went back into prison another couple of times. What was the trigger for you that said, this is just not me, this is not for me, this is not okay?
Do you know what, Julie, right? On my third and final stretch, I've nearly been out of prison in 4 days. It will be 2 years since I've actually left prison. And what it was, this is crazy, this is how the story comes full circle, and I guess I come full circle as well in many regards, is the fact that on my last stretch, right, in the last couple of years, I've got a very, very good bond with my mother. And like I said, we've covered the early years and stuff like that and what I'd been through. Whilst I was in prison, even though I don't like relying on anybody for anything, because I'm in prison, I can't keep my property and check my mail because I'm in prison. So my mum stepped up massively. So she didn't approve of me being in prison, but we had a very good bond. Now, what it was.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I rang her partner that she was with at the time and he said, like, as she told you that she, like, she thinks she had a stroke and, like, she had a heart, she's got a heart condition called angina. And she'd been having, like, really tight chest and stuff, and she thought she was, like, a little heart attack slash stroke. He told me this on the phone. He said she's not sleeping, she's not eating, it's affecting her psychologically, emotionally, not to mention financially, because the financial restraints of supporting somebody in prison is astronomical, week, month, year, do you know what I mean? So, and she's working 60-hour week, right, for minimum wage again. And then she's traveling 2.5 hours to come on a visit. Then she's spending an hour on the visit, 2.5 hours back. In between that, she was going to my property. She was getting into debt because I didn't know this. Because I was spiraling into rent arrears, she was putting it on her credit card, which obviously the APR on the credit card, the payments was higher. And it was stressing her out. And I, for some reason, I'd never seen this myself on a visit. But because this guy had told me, and I actually had a visit with my mum a few hours later, and my mum's come on the visit, and I'm sat there at this private prison in Salford near Manchester, this Forest Bank prison, and my mum comes on the visit and stuff, and I'm sat there looking at her, and I'm looking at her hands and stuff because she's getting older, because she's, like I say, and then the fact that she smokes so much, and she's like, because she's like breathing heavy because she's battered her lungs through smoking over years for decades, seeing the bags under her eyes, seeing the fact that she was trying to put a brave face on it, I became incredibly guilt-ridden in that moment and stuff. And I really, really, like, I felt unsettled. It made me unsettled on the visit. I was looking at my mum and I'm thinking, you're trying to put a brave face onto me because she's a strong woman and she's not trying to show your weakness in front of me. I didn't see, because I was self-centered, because when you're in prison, as mad as it sounds, you become very selfish to an extent. It's all about you and stuff, and you feel like the prisoners' families don't understand what you're going through because they're not in prison, when the reality is they're on the roller coaster that is prison right with you. So anyway, cut a long story short, the visit finished, we stood up, I give her a hug, I hugged her especially tight on this, like, hug, I like a big bear hug. The visit finished, she left, I went and sat, I went back to the wing and stuff, sat in myself. That we end up getting locked up, and I cried myself to sleep that night. I felt incredibly guilty. I felt guilt-ridden. It just didn't sit very well with me. And between falling asleep and waking up, I had like an epiphany and like a light bulb moment. And I woke up the next day, and this journey of prison again, where I'd contemplated suicide, and I was up and I was down and I was aggravated and frustrated and stuff. I lost myself, and then in that moment, I'd found myself, and I was thinking clearly, more clearly than I'd ever thought in my life. And a few weeks later, eventually, I was released, and I met my mum. My mum came and picked me up from the jail. I walked outside, I gave her the biggest hug. We set off, and I said to her, I said, I promise you, I will never, ever, ever put you through what I put you through. On them last couple of stretches, I said, no. I said, I apologize from the bottom of my heart. And you know what? I went to probation, and I saw probation. He wasn't ready. So I went into the local area, got a breakfast because I was starving, went back to probation, and then, ended up just like, got back to my address, checked my mails, went out for food with my mom, and was forever grateful. And to be honest with you, it was the making of me. Now, like I say, the strange thing is, and the thing that, like, is crazy, the fact that I believe that my childhood played a contributing factor in my criminality and definitely in my violent tendencies and my violent nature. And the way I, and the reason I came away from crime was for the same reason, my mum, which is crazy.
Do you think if somebody that was skeptical in terms of maybe the psychology behind that, if they were to say to you, well, actually, years of trauma means there needs to be a real rehabilitative or reparative parenting, in the same way as that we have kind of that reparative support given to offenders when they're released, you know, in different ways by probation or outside services. Now, thinking about that in terms of your relationship with your mum, it wouldn't be unusual for us to say that no matter what a young person goes through, they will always gravitate back towards family, because we want to have that bond, we want to have that relationship with our family, and we seek it. Doesn't matter what they've put, we'll still, and you probably know this better than I would in experiencing wise, but you always want that relationship to be a good one. It doesn't matter what sort of parent you have, whether that's somebody who absolutely shows you affection in later years or not, you will seek it anyway. And so what conversations did you have with your mum that kind of made it okay and put everything to bed? Because she must be feeling somewhat of the pinch and the guilt as you talk about it in interviews and talk about your experiences. There must be something in there for her that still, you know, really affects her.
Do you know what? To be honest with you, Julie, no. We've never really had, right? People ask me this question a lot. Like, I speak at universities now to criminology students and stuff. And I always get asked, like, why do you forgive your mum? Why have you now got a bond with her? Why have you had the conversation with her? Have you had it out with her? Like, have you discussed at length about what you went through, what it did to you and stuff like that? And the reality is, no, I've never. And to be honest with you, I don't think I ever would. I would never want to put my mum in a position where she felt uncomfortable. Now, as mad as this sounds, Julian, people freak out when I say this and they can't get their head around it and they can't grasp it. People say to me a lot, like, so if you could go back to your childhood and be born to another family, be raised with money, morals, principles, and everything in between, or go back and live exactly the life minute for minute, second for second, I'd do it all over again in a heartbeat, simply because it's made me who I am today. I am very streetwise. I've become very respectful. I'm very street. I can handle myself massively. Everything that's been ever thrown at me in my life, I've been homeless twice. I've been in prison three times. I've been shot at. I've been stabbed. I'm physically scarred, mentally scarred, and emotionally scarred. And strangely enough, I've actually come out the other end as a decent person, and that's crazy to say. I'm actually volunteering now with an organization here in Manchester. I start on Friday, that actually help ex-offenders, people that have battled mental health issues, addiction, homelessness, and ex-offenders. And I can't wait. And I can only do this because I've been on this journey of self-discovery and stuff. And like I say, I do forgive my mum for what she put me through. And I also, where my past I used to drag my past around like a ball and chain, and I could never move forward with my life because I was always looking back. I used to talk in past tense. I'd always talk about the past and violence and stuff. And then now I only look back to see how far I've come. I really, really do. And I'm very grateful for the bad things that have happened and the good things, because when I was in prison, had it not been for my mum and the emotional support that she gave me whilst I was in prison, honestly, I think I'd be dead. I think I would have taken my own life in prison, because psychologically, and I'm not ashamed to say this, prison brought me to my knees. I'm not going to lie to you. Anyone that says they've been to prison and haven't cried or haven't contemplated suicide or spiraled into depression, simply put, they're a liar. Prison psychologically, emotionally, and like I say, just it takes its toll on you and also those around you. And my mum put me through a lot, and I'm sort of grateful for it because it's part and parcel of me. I accepted that, and I use my experiences to educate, deter, or, like I say, speak to criminology students and stuff, and I get a lot of pleasure from it, but I'm a different person now, the way I project myself, the way that I carry myself, and the way that I see things as well, definitely much so.
Yeah, I certainly wasn't meaning to come across as though I was questioning why you would want that relationship with your mum, because it's absolutely normal and natural that we would. And there are many examples of people who who don't have to have those conversations, but just move forward and take the learning with them into both of their relationships, but not having to really speak about it. So total admiration that you've turned that round and you're more settled now and you're able to support others. One of the key parts of your life now is about helping with the, I suppose, the reforming of the prison service. As you've already alluded to, there are many different experiences of different prisons, depending on who is running them. And also in terms of the supporting criminology students and those, and trying to also, with your voluntary work, prevent some of those young people getting involved in activities that are not going to be helpful to them later on or place them at risk. So in terms of your, let's look at the reforming of prisons first. What do you think needs to change in our prison system?
I mean, obviously, for obviously the listeners, obviously this going out in the States now, the prison population here in the UK fluctuates between 83 to about 86,000, give or take. Now, we've got one of the high, that's going to rise to over 90,000 in the next couple of years. We've got one of the highest prison populations in Europe. For the past couple of years, we've seen record levels of violence and self-harm. The amount of prisoners leaving prison in body bags, whether it be natural causes or whether it be self-inflicted deaths, suicides, obviously, is absolutely astronomical. Now, the truth is, prisoners here in the UK, you're housing some of the most vulnerable and susceptible people in society, and they've not had the best starts in life. I've been in prison with people with serious mental health issues, undiagnosed, diagnosed, and the fact is housing somebody in prison costs about £40,000 per annum, where if you're going to put them in a high security psychiatric unit, we've got three in the UK. We've got Rampton, we've got Broadmoor, and we've got Ashworth. Now, if you put a prisoner with serious mental health issues in Ashworth, for example, you're talking around £350,000 a year. But the thing is, you're paying for that one-on-one care, the medication, the psychiatrist, and the help that comes with it, that one-on-one care to try and help these people, or at least suppress them and try to help them and medicate them. In the prison system here in the UK, we're just throwing mentally ill people in prison. And like I say, you're seeing contraband's a massive problem as well. Where you've got contraband, you've got debt. Where you've got contraband, for those that don't know, is mobile phones, drugs, new psychoactive substances like spice, even tobacco now because the smoking ban and stuff. Now, where you've got contraband, you've got debt. Where you've got debt, you've got fear, intimidation, bullying and violence. Mental health services are inadequate within prisons. We need to dramatically reduce the prison population. Reoffending in the UK costs the taxpayer around £15 billion a year. Now, every time I do an interview, and everyone plays devil's advocate, so Cody, what would you say if you say that we're going soft on prisoners? And I'm like, there's two things, right? You can't brutalize and rehabilitate someone at the same time, right? The punitive measure of prison is losing your liberty, right? Once we get over that, prisons need to be places of skills training, education, reintegration, resettlement. And like I say, that's what it should be about. And technically, that's what people would like you to believe prison currently is. But there's no consistency. And for me, rather than making prisoners out of our students, let's make students out of our prisoners. And it frustrates me to see what's going on within the prison system. As someone that's served behind my door and stuff and seen what goes on within the wing and seen prisoners physically leave prison in body bags and stuff and speaking to their families and people being murdered and stuff. We had like four last year. We've already had one murder this year at Risley Prison in Warrington. I would dramatically reduce the prison population. I would abolish short sentences because they're counterproductive. There's no sentencing plan. I would defer sentencing for prisoners that are mentally ill. I would get a psychiatric report done on them. And if they have to be in prison, simple, section them, put them in a psychiatric unit, whether it be medium, whether it be high. The fact is, prison simply doesn't work. Now, by brutalizing prisoners, most people in the UK, most people want to brutalize prisoners from the right side of the tracks, the whiter than white, and they want to brutalize. Now, by brutalizing prisoners and housing them in these squalid conditions and these decrepit, Victorian, run-down prisons, which you wouldn't put your dog in, all that simply does is it succeeds only in demoralizing, desensitizing, dehumanizing, and making you even more disenfranchised than when you entered the system. Now, here in the UK, we've got lowest police figures since, I believe, 1996. Under the Tory government, we've lost in excess of 21,000 officers, give or take. Now, the streets here in the UK are lawless. Community police stations are closing down. Youth services have been cut. So police reaction times are down. Crimes are going unreported, uninvestigated, and unsolved as well. And the reality is, it's lawless. And you've got these people in prison that are leaving prison. Like I say, they're being spat out. They're being chewed up and spat out, demoralized, desensitized, dehumanized, right? And that only creates monsters. Now, like I say, with fewer police on the streets, what do you think these people are going to do? It's a green light for criminals across the board to commit crime. So, and the fact that prison doesn't work for the most part, hence why reoffending rates are so high. It's just, the system's as broken as those entering it. It's as simple as that. It really, really is.
So, again, moving forward from that, because I think you raise a lot of really interesting points. In terms of your ongoing contact, you're in a lot of contact still with people in prison, aren't you?
Yes, I am, very much so, yeah.
So would you... I mean, again, you say that people play devil's advocate. I'm not doing that, but I am intrigued as to why you would do that. Do you think that that's part of your ongoing recovery?
Do you know what? That's a good question, actually. Yeah, do you know what? Because my mum always says this to me. She says, look, you're outside of prison now, right? You've been out for nearly 2 years, right? Why are you still doing interviews? Why are you still doing the YouTube stuff? Because I do all the YouTube videos and stuff, prison news, what to pack for prison, contact for prisoners, families and stuff. And like I say, and then I've spoken to serving prisoners just the other day. And like I say, what it is, it's like, I'm trying to help them and I'm trying to give prisoners a voice. Now, what I do in the UK, I get contacted by quite a few journalists and stuff to do interviews on prison issue. Now, I'm slowly coming away from that because I've been out nearly 2 years and my experiences I'm no longer relevant to be truthful. Even though I know my prison and stuff, the face of prison is ever changing. But what I do is I keep networking with prisoners' girlfriends, prisoners' families, prisoners' mothers, serving prisoners and stuff. And what I'm doing is I'm building a little network and I'm actually giving prisoners a voice. And I'm trying to help them where I can help them or advise their families and stuff like that. And just being supportive on the other end of the phone where you've got a prisoner's partner that's her fella's rang her, he's suicidal, and stuff like that. And then I'm ringing the prison, I'm trying to speak to the chaplain, even going as far as to ring the police in one circumstance. So like I say, I'm just trying to provide a service where I can. I mean, like I say, I'm not an expert on anything. I'm simply an expert in my own experiences. Now, if I can use that, people often say to me, Cody, why do you keep trying to help people and stuff? You don't get paid for it. And the fact is if you gain knowledge through something, through whether it be a negative experience or a good experience, what is the point in having that knowledge if you're not going to spread that knowledge and share that knowledge and help other people, right? Surely that is the aim. If you know something and you can help somebody, then help them. Now, like I say, I don't give it help that's infactual or that's non-productive. If they ask me a question and I can't answer them, simply put, I will go away and I'll speak to someone that can give me the answer. And I just try to help people, but asking me, has it helped me? Then on the YouTube side of things, like where I do the YouTube stuff, the vlogs and stuff, that started off as I had a lot going on in my head after leaving prison. And I thought that if I put it into a video format, I didn't put any tags on my video or anything, so people couldn't really find it because it was no tags on it or anything. It was helping me offload the psyche because I wasn't hurting people or like involved in any form of criminality, and I walked away from everything and everyone I'd ever known. I didn't want to hurt people, so I've got all this going on in my head. So, and I'm not one of these people that wants to go and speak to a doctor or a psychiatrist. I simply offloaded onto these videos on YouTube. Slowly, I started to gain a following and stuff, and it sort of went from there. So it has helped me, definitely very much so, in the sense of getting my experiences and what's going on in my head out. It's de-stressed me, and by doing so as well, it's also helped other people, which has helped me. So it's both been beneficial to me, and it's also helped prisoners' girlfriends, people that are potentially going to prison for the first time, to try and like mentally prepare them for prison. Not that you can, but trying to help them in some which way. Speaking to kids down in Taunton in Somerset, where he was from a good family and he was going down a criminal route and his girlfriend cheated on him and he wanted to hurt her and hurt the fella. And just talking to him and saying, look, mate, you're from a good family, you're going to end up in prison. And trying to deter people and detract people from doing what I used to do, because I don't want to see them end up killing somebody or being themselves killed. Because like I say, the lawlessness of what's going on in the streets in the UK with knife crime, gun crime, and like I say, they just... under the overwhelming lack of police is off the scale. So it's helped me, it's helped other people, and I'm very grateful for that, definitely, Julie, yeah.
And you would have learned quite a lot from other people as well and their experiences, talking to, so for example, serial killers, and trying to understand how other people's minds work and how some people cannot move on from their position because there's another, a different driving force than the one that you had. What was probably the most worrying for you and the, probably the one person you really wanted to help, but you knew there was nothing you could do?
What are you talking about? Serial killer, in a serial killer sense?
Yeah, in terms of somebody who is a prolific or a repeat offender, and you were kind of emotionally connected with that situation, not in terms of maybe what they did, but certainly with the empathy for that person. But knew that there was a limit to what you could do, and there was probably very little help this person could receive.
Yeah, like I say, I've wrote to quite a few high-profile prisoners, whether it be serial killers, murderers, people like Charles Bronson, things like that. So Charles Bronson isn't the actor, by the way. He's a famous, infamous prisoner here in the UK that's one of Britain's longest-serving prisoners. I've wrote to a lot of these different people and stuff, and the reason that I write to these people is because I'm a thick, uneducated street kid, but I've always had an interest in sort of criminology, forensic psychology. Why do people do what they do? And when you write to these people, like these serial killers and stuff, you feel I don't support them in any which way. The crimes are deplorable and stuff. But the thing is, what I understand is that it stems from something, whether it be a triggering childhood or whatever the case may be. Now, the one interesting person that I wrote to and I dialed into was Ian Brady, the serial killer, the Moors murderer, as he's known. He was born in Gorbals, district of Glasgow, which is like the slums, ended up being sent by a sheriff down to Manchester. He committed his crimes in an area that where I like used to live and stuff. And when I was in Strangeways, prison, HMP Manchester, I read a book on Brady. Now, I read a lot of this, it was like a true crime book and stuff. And when I left the prison, because he'd obviously been in Strangeways himself before the murders, and I just read about him and I thought, I'm going to reach out, and I reached out to him. And it's like a morbid, because it's a bit macabre, isn't it? But I wanted to understand his logic, why he did what he did, and try and get inside the mindset of this so-called intellectual or pseudo-intellectual, as a lot of people call Brady. And, yeah, I sort of, there's a lot of similarities in the sense of, like, we've both been in trouble. He'd been in Borstal. I'd not obviously been in Borstal and stuff. And he just opened up to me and divulged a lot. And then you're learning the information. I had an agenda every time I wrote to him. I was trying to naively believe that I could get the location of one of his last victim, the last victim that's not been found, Keith Bennett. And I wrote to him, because what it was I believe, Julie, that everyone that's writing to Brady at the time was going to be an academic or a student of psychology, forensic psychology, like I say, authors, journalists, and everything in between. Now, as a common criminal, I thought he's more inclined to trust me than he would, let's say, an academic, because he's going to see an agenda there. Now, I have my own agenda, but I wanted to see, can I hang with this class, like this so-called pseudo-intellectual, this so-called intelligent guy that was ahead of his time? Could I hang with him? Could I conversate with this person? And like I say, the fact he committed his crimes near where I lived, and like I knew a lot of the areas and stuff like that, and I knew that Myra Hindley's ashes were spreading apart down near Staley Bridge or Ashton-under-Lyne in Greater Manchester Tameside. I just wrote to him and stuff, and I wanted to, and I felt a connection there in the sense of, I was trying to get inside, did he have a similar childhood to me, what was the trigger, what, it's like, I wrote to Dennis Nielsen as well. Dennis Nielsen was another one that, I think he was very close with his grandfather, and his grandfather was a fisherman, and he went out to sea, and I think he had a heart attack on the boat, and obviously he tried to drown himself, and he wrote this manuscript called The Drowning Boy, and I try to understand my own thing. I can't pinpoint a specific, oh, this is what it was and this was the connection I felt, or this is why. All it was I was raised watching serial killers documentaries, gangs documentaries and gangsters, and like an idiot, people study these subjects and go to university and become very successful people. I, like an idiot, became involved with all of the above. And it was a morbid curiosity mixed with, I think people, when you write to these people, I think people confuse interest with it, like with supporting the individual. Now, if I was ever in a room with Brady, I would have attacked him. But he wouldn't accept my offer to go and see him at Ashworth Psychiatric Unit. But God knows I tried. I don't think I really answered that question, Julie, very well, but sorry.
No, I think you did. And I think,
right.
I'm absolutely horrified, really, and gutted that we've run out of time, because your story is so crucial for people to hear. You know, the journey through, the healing that's gone on without healing, if that makes sense, the ability to cope with what's been without the kind of the therapeutic and the that kind of healing stuff as well. It's turn your life around, and you're incredibly, you know, eloquent and able to portray your message. You're a great speaker, Cody. And you know, and for you to be able to be very honest and open about your situation, the things that you've done and been through, and you don't go into detail, you don't need to go into detail about events. You're portraying the way you're doing it. You know, hats off to you.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.